to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations with professionals in the nonprofit world. I'm Janice Cunning, and I'm here with my partner, Margaret, and we're thrilled to welcome back to the podcast, Crystal Cherry. Welcome back, hey. Crystal.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it wasn't actually that long ago. I was looking up. It was episode 89. You joined us and you talked about creating a healthy board.
Yes. So
if people want to go back and listen to that, we encourage them to do that. And today we're going to talk about also a topic related to boards, because you are indeed the president of the Board Pro and our resident expert, I feel like, at Fundraising Leadership on Board Relations. And you wrote a great post for us about belonging and creating a sense of belonging on boards.
Yeah. That's kind of the new space that I'm in. I still work with boards and all the other things, you know, governance and fundraising and recruitment and conflict resolution. I still do all of that work as well. But a lot of my clients of late seems to be working on this DEI stuff. And so I've found myself kind of like entrenched in this work, and it has turned out to be a really rewarding part of being a board consultant. And I'm learning so much, not only about boards, but about myself. And so it's been good. And so now I've partnered with another colleague, Dr. Renee Rubin Ross, from the Ross Collective, who is also a consultant who works in the nonprofit space. And she and I have partnered to create this DEI experience for boards that we're very proud of and that seems to be resonating with our clients.
Yeah. Right. Crystal, so I read your blog, and when I first started reading, like, I just felt a stomach ache, honestly. I mean, I felt a stomach ache because sometimes this topic feels so overwhelming. You know, how do you make progress? You know, and then there was a second part in which you sort of, I think we're talking about a specific board that, you know, not everybody showed up. And so I know there are a few questions in there, but again, like, I started reading and I was like, oh, how is this going to have any kind of happy ending? And, you know, so just share, like,
go ahead. Yeah. So that board was, that was a very intense retreat that we had with that particular nonprofit. It's in the South. And the board is a large board. It's more than 30 people, which is very unusual. And part of the board is our appointees by a political professional. So they are by the mayor of that city. And so the political appointees, you know, they're on there because the mayor wanted them to be on there. So for many of them, it's something to put on your resume. But it's an interesting board in that it is diverse. There are Black, white, and others on the board. And in this training that we started doing with them, I guess about 3 months ago, we welcomed all board members. We had one big board meeting and they all, not all came, but most of them came. And then as time went on, we started noticing the absence of the white men on the board. The white women showed, and the Black the Black men and women showed, but the white men were visibly absent. And so that was very, very interesting. I think we had two who kind of stuck with us, but most of them did not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it still felt possible to make some change, to put in a different intention around culture and DEI there, even with people missing.
Yeah, because the ones who did come were willing. You know, they were really wanting to make the change. And I think we started creating space where people felt comfortable being their authentic selves. And we had some really tough conversations and some things that were said that startled everyone. I think that last board retreat, I left there feeling mentally and emotionally exhausted.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, as a facilitator, as a Black woman, I certainly understood some of the people of color in the room and their frustrations. But I also understand white people who are really authentically trying to understand what's going on. After reading Resma's book, My Grandmother's Hands, where he talks about how all of us carry pain in our bodies with us based on the experiences that we felt, white, Black, and all other. And I think that is really true. So that last board retreat was emotionally exhausting, but it was also exhilarating because I feel like they had come to a place where they were now starting to open up and starting to feel comfortable really saying what was on their heart. I mean, this is hard work. It's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard work and it's heart work, right? Mm. And I felt like that they were really starting to open up and share what was on their hearts, and people were willing to receive it, even if it was uncomfortable. Just like in the case, you know, with the board member Stan, who said, "You know what? I'm not interested in working with white people. You know, if they don't want to play nice, you know, that's on them. I have other things I can be doing. I can go back to my community where I belong." And where I know I can make some strides. I'm not here to try to convince white people that it makes sense to work with all people. Right. And you know, everybody was kind of like, whoa, when he said that. Yeah. But you know, we just got quiet for a minute. I let everybody sit in that. You know, let's just, how does that feel? And Renee, who is my counterpart, who is white, you know, she just said to everyone, how do you feel? How does what Stan said make you feel? You know, and it was pretty, pretty interesting. We had one white woman who shared how embarrassed she feels by what's happened in the past. She realizes that she herself is not responsible, but that she benefits from the systemic privileges that, you know, that our society provides her. But how embarrassed and humiliated that she feels because of what her ancestors may have done to hurt other people, so much so that she said, and we were all startled by this statement, "Sometimes I feel like I wish I can scrub the white off my body." Mm-hmm. And we were all like, but for her to feel comfortable, that's a pretty blatant statement. And for her to feel comfortable saying that, we just took that as a compliment to the fact that we had created a brave space for people to say those kinds of things and not worry about how it was going to land. But she said it, he said it, and we just let people sit in it and feel that discomfort. And then talk through how we can get past it. So even though it was a tough meeting and we didn't get to finish all that we thought we were going to do with that board, but because these conversations were going on, we just decided to pause. We were going to do an action plan at the end where we all walked away with goals that we never got to the action plan. We just decided this conversation is so robust and people are here and they're present and they're speaking and they're opening up. Let's just do this. And now as a result of that, they have now since contacted us and said, "We want you to come back and finish."
Still need to do the action plan.
We feel your pain. How often does that happen?
Yeah.
Right, if I go in somewhere and you're like, "Well, this is more important than," so I'm just going to throw out that plan.
Yeah. But
Crystal, I want to just take a step back for a second. Cause I think like so much powerful stuff in what you said, but the big thing is, I think a lot of people are like, how do I even start, right? So how did, like, what are some actual things that you did, you and your co-facilitator, to create a space where that could even happen?
Right. So we, this retreat that we had a couple of weeks ago was the final retreat. We had done a lot of work leading up to this point. Both of us had each led a session. I led a session on how to interrupt bias, where we had, we watched videos and we did a role play and we had small group work. We broke out into breakout rooms and, you know, created a scenario where they could work on something and then come back and report and talk it through. And then Renee came back and talked about white supremacy, which was also very interesting in that part of the country, because we received some resistance when she did her part, when we just talked about characteristics of white supremacy and what that looked like, you know, individualism, you know, feeling like you have a right to comfort, immediacy, all those things that we know. And so we did that. And then we broke out and we did caucuses. So we divided the board by race. And so she did a white caucus, I did a people of color caucus, and we separated and we did our own work with our own groups. And then we came back together and shared what the other group had done. And we used books, we used How to Talk About Race, and we used My Grandmother's Hands and asked them to read a chapter in each of those books. And then we talked about that. So we had done some deep work with this board leading up to this retreat so that they were kind of familiar with our style and making it clear that it was okay to be authentic. We also, one of the things that Renee and I do is we have our board go through race stories. So each board member shares their own race autobiography and talks about their childhood, where they're from, you know, how they identified, how race was talked about or not talked about in their families. When did they realize they were different? You know, how did you feel if you heard someone in your family make a racial slur? And all those kinds of things. So we had done some deep work with this board. And then we also shared our own race stories. So I think by modeling vulnerability and sharing that, we all have had said some things that we may regret, or we may have all experienced some kind of racism in our lives, made them feel like, okay, well, these two, they're not thinking they're better than us or anything. They're just like us. And I think having a cross-racial team, particularly in the South, really helped, because having a white person and a Black person, you know, some people resonated more with her or some people resonate more with me, but it all seemed to kind of come together. So we had done all of this work leading up to this retreat. And one of the things that we really emphasized is that before you can delve into this work, you do have to take a selfie. You know, you do have to do your own work. You really kind of have to come to terms with what's happened. You know, we tell people, don't try to deny history, you know, learn about it, accept it, hold on to it, and then use it to figure out how we can make things better in the future. No one is personally pointing fingers at you saying, you're the bad guy, you're the bad guy, you're the bad guy. But we are pointing out what's happened to people and how it has hundreds of years later continues to hurt people and then some people gain from what happened. So yeah, so it's not something you don't just walk in a room and start talking right, about.
Yeah.
You okay, have to do all this go. Work.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, two things really stand out to me about what you're saying. And the first is, just sort of this validation, like everybody's journey brought them to this place, right? That it's not right or wrong, like that you get rid of sort of those binaries and just hold space for like, okay, here we are, you know, right. I love that. And I love also that you're calling it a brave space instead of a safe space. And I'm guessing that's a very intentional word that you've chosen.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about why that instead of safe space, which is what we're used to hearing?
Yeah, because, you know, a brave space means that, you know, you may say something that may be offensive to someone. You may say something that someone else might not understand. You might use a word that other people are not accustomed to hearing, and it's okay. We provide an opportunity for you to fumble, but a responsibility to repair. So that's what we say to people. Say what's on your heart. If it's offensive to someone, once the person, if they feel like they want to tell you that it's offensive, then you acknowledge that. And then if you can repair that. But we don't want you to not say anything. Like our board member, Stan, who at first was fidgeting in his seat. He was just looking down. And when we called on him, he was reluctant. He was like, no, I don't really want to say anything. And we said, you know, are you sure? Because this is the place to say it. And then he just kind of blurted out, you know, I don't want to work with white people. We were like, what? And so he, you know, and then after people say things like that, we thank them for their courage, you know, because it's not easy to say that in a space where you're looking at 5, 6, 8, 10 white faces and you say to them, I don't want to work with you. I'm not interested. You know, so this brave space is a space for you to say what's on your heart, you know, as long as you're not using any profanity or you're not, you know, blatantly insulting anyone. We want you to be able to feel that you can say what's on your heart. So it's safe and brave.
Yeah, and there's a way in which what's coming up for me is how important. Well, a few things. One is how important it is to have people like you who really are like trained and, you know how to do this work. I mean, I just want to say that, you know, like how important it is to have facilitators. But I'm also curious for you. I mean, like you said, this is heavy work, you know, and so impactful and so important, but heavy. Like, how do you show up and how do you also get the support that you need to be able to continue to show up in that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had to take a selfie and really kind of, I had not, prior to doing this work, thought about my own race story and how I grew up and how race was talked about or not talked about in my family. And I realized, you know, I grew up in a, you know, with parents who are civil rights movement kind of people, came, you know, they were of age in their 60s, but had the mindset that really that white people were better. And that it was our responsibility to make them feel comfortable. Like, so for example, I remembered one time we were in a mall or something and we were going to the escalator and our family and a white family got to the top of the escalator at the same time. And we actually got there maybe a little bit before them. So I was about to step on and my mom pushed me out of the way and said, move out the way and let them go. And she said to the mother, sorry. And I'm thinking, I remember thinking, well, why couldn't we get on first? I don't understand why we had to step aside and let them get on. But it was kind of like, we need to let you know we're not a threat. You can go first. My children are being meddling. They're in your way, so I'll get them out of your way. As a child, I didn't understand what that meant. I just thought it was weird. But I remember that incident recently and hadn't really thought about it. But, you know, after doing this work, I started thinking about my childhood and the messages I was receiving from my parents. And there was always this talk about the white man. I remember being on the floor playing with my dolls and hearing my father and his friends talking about the white man, how the white man was going to do this and the white man wasn't going to let us do that. And I just kept thinking to myself, who is this white man? Like, what is he? Why is he so mean? And is he coming to my house? Like, who is this? You know, I didn't realize he was talking about a group of people. I thought it was one man because they just kept calling him the white man. And so, like, in my mind as a kid, I was like, I'm just really scared of the white man because I don't know who he is and he seems to be like a bad guy. But like all of those things started coming back to me as an adult after I started doing this work. I had not really thought about it. And so I had to kind of come to terms with my own upbringing and how did I feel about myself? Did I feel like I was less than, you know? And am I relaying that information, that message to my son? And am I carrying that pain with me? And so all of that work had to be done by me. It continues to be done by me as I lead and facilitate these groups. And so I share that with the boards that I work with. And then of course, Renee, who is, you know, has become not only a colleague, but as a friend. She's a white woman. She lives in California, raised there. I'm raised in New York. So we're completely different, have different lived experiences. But I consider her a friend, a colleague, and sort of a mentor. And so often we'll talk after a board meeting and we'll just kind of lift each other up and she'll go, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, just barely. And we just kind of say, okay, well, hang in there, go get some water, go get some fresh air. It's going to be okay. Let's talk about it later. So I rely a lot on her for some of the emotional, so and vice versa, for some of the emotional support. And she's very, very sensitive to some of the, we've experienced, even in working together, some biases in the way that I'm treated in the way that she's treated. Mm. So for example, we worked with a client at first they told me that I had to, we were going to travel to go to our retreat. And they told me that I was responsible to pay for my own airfare and be reimbursed. And then another person who maybe didn't know about what the other person had done offered to pay, said, asked Renee for her travel information and they would use the company, they would use the organization's credit card. Mm. So they were going to have me pay for my own travel and then wait for it to be reimbursed after the retreat. And yet Renee, they were going to offer to buy her travel and everything up front. But these were two different people. And so they apologized profusely and they said it had nothing to do with race and nothing to do with color. But we wondered. Yeah. So it's just those kinds of things.
Yes.
It's just those kinds of things. I've done retreats where I've had white men resign from the board after having an experience with us because they just said, I don't want to do that work. Mm. So, and we tell people, you know, you're going to experience some losses. Everyone's not going to stay on for this ride. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you have someone because I think that's, you know, that's so important, right? Have a safe space for yourself, you know, because you're out there being brave, but sometimes, it's just nice to have a soft place to land.
Yes.
Your partner, Margaret and I know well with our partnership. So, so I'm curious about, I love that you're bringing in belonging because I think we sort of started, you know, with diversity and equity. And then we sort of started to move to inclusion. And I've had a lot of interesting conversations over the last couple of years with people who are, you know, maybe concerned that boards are like, okay, we're going to get some people who have diverse, you know, look diverse or are diverse in some way on our board. And they're saying to me, but like, okay, but we're not changing fundamentally anything that we're doing on this board.
Yeah.
And so there isn't going to necessarily be a sense of belonging. And then, you know, and then people might have a terrible experience. Like you said, they might not want to stay. They might want to go back, you know, to something they've done before. So I guess my question is like, yeah, what is it to you to belong, and how do nonprofit boards in particular actually that feeling?
Yeah, Janice, thank you for bringing that up, because I think a lot of nonprofits think, you know, well, we've added three people of color to our team, so we're done.
Check, check, check. You know, we're done.
And we told them they could come to a board meeting. We've included them. You know, and so, you know, so diversity is one thing. Even inclusion is another thing. You could tell people, yeah, you could come to the meeting. But once we get to the meeting, what's the culture like? You know, what kind of language are you using? What kind of images are you using? Are you acknowledging that I'm even in the room? Are you even acknowledging that I'm different? It's okay. You know, and so the worst thing we can say is we don't see color. Mm-hmm. That's what we were all taught. Oh, you don't see color. People, everyone's the same. Everyone is not the same. We're all equal, but we're not the same. You know, and so acknowledging, saying things like, you know how when we all get embarrassed, we all turn red. Mm. When we blush, we turn. You know how when you blush and your face turns red, and there are like 10 people in the room going, no, my face doesn't turn red. So to make a blanket statement like that, right? So the language that you use in a board meeting or in any kind of meeting is really important. So yeah, having four new people of color on the board, that's good. Telling them they can come to the meeting, including them, that's nice. But what does that culture feel like once they get there? Do they have that opportunity to speak up? Are their ideas welcomed? Do you ask for their opinions before you post a negative picture in the annual report reflecting that race, right? And then do you acknowledge that, you know, this person celebrates a certain holiday during this time of the month. So maybe we don't have a board meeting that time, but you know that person is not going to be able to attend. Or this person is a caregiver and has elderly parents, or maybe they are a single mom and have three or four children. They can't make a board meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning or all the way out in the suburbs because they don't have a car. You know, whatever it is, you know, not acknowledging the way that people are and the biases that are inherently built into our, you know, the wealth gap, all of those things, right? And so not acknowledging that you do have people on your board who are different, who have different experiences and different access to things, you know? So for instance, you know, telling all board members, our board retreat is in Montana. We're all in Florida. And this year we're gonna have our board retreat in Montana. Pay for all your travel, get your airplane ticket, pay for the cabin, pay for the Uber, the parking, and all that. You know, it's gonna cost you, you know, $1,500, $1,800. Go ahead and buy that, and then we'll reimburse you after the retreat is over in 2 months. And you assume, some people say, okay, fine, yeah, I'll put it on my credit card, I'll send you the receipts. And some people are thinking, oh God, do I have $1,800 on my credit card to put this money out? And if I do put it out, am I going to be able to get the refrigerator that I need because my refrigerator is broke? Because now I got to put $1,800 on my credit card to travel, but I also need to have cushion money in case something happens, right? And so assuming that everybody on the board is in a position to do that and not even questioning or asking, you know, or saying, for those of you for whom this is uncomfortable, if you'd like us to purchase your travel up front, we'll be happy to do that for you. But to make a blanket policy that everyone needs to pay for their travel and assume that everyone is in a position to do that comfortably, it shows bias. And that's a blind spot. And so it's those kinds of things that we really get boards to look at that they don't even think about, that they may not have even considered. So,
yeah. You're talking about some of the systemic blind spots. And I'm curious, you know, also like with the person to person, you know, what do you see there? you know, what can you shine a light on?
Yeah. So, you
how,
know,
how do we butcher it one-on-one sometimes?
Yeah.
And like, fix it.
How do we fix it? Yes.
In one of my webinars, I do a role play for a situation that actually happened to me in real life on a board where I had a board member ask to touch my hair. And before I could even respond, she was touching my hair. And when I tried to explain to her that I'm not a pet and that I'm not to be petted and that you didn't even wait for me to respond before you felt, oh, can I touch your hair? You know, now, if you're curious about the texture of my hair and how it feels, we can have that conversation and I'm happy to share that with you. And I may or may not let you touch my hair once we have that conversation, but that's permission based. And that's after we've had the conversation and we've kind of set the tone for what you want to do. But for you to ask me to touch my hair and touch my hair before I can even respond, it's very offensive. And then for you to say, oh my God, I didn't mean it. You know, I didn't mean anything by it. I love your hair. I love the color. I love, you know, all the stuff that, you know. And so those are the kinds of blind spots that you don't have a right to touch a person's body. I don't care how curious you are, you know, and you certainly don't do it without their permission.
Yeah, there's a place to just, you know, you're a facilitator, you're skilled, you're reading space, but you're sort of describing sitting on Stan a little bit, you know, like really deeply inviting him to speak. And, you know, I know that's there's an element of introversion, of fear, but, you know, what do you think there, like when you're in board meetings and you see that it looks like maybe somebody has something to say and they seem reluctant?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't force anybody. He was reluctant at first.
Yeah.
And then I guess he thought about it and maybe he just said, you know what, it seems like they're providing a space for me to be able to say what I want to say. And he just, like I said, he just kind of blurted it out. You know, you could see that there was some caution because he was like, okay, so I talked to Stan afterwards. I went up to him and talked to him. And as it turns out, he was invited to be on the board by the executive director who knew about him and knew his temperament. And so I think secretly the executive director wants to shake things up by inviting people like Stan to be on the board. So his being there was intentional. But I had a conversation with him afterwards and I said, listen, I said, I understand how you feel. And you certainly have a right to not work with people you don't want to work with, you know, but quite frankly, they need you. You know, they need people like you who are brave enough to say what's really on your heart. And I said, it's a reflection also of your passion. You know, the fact that you're here, it was a 4-hour retreat. You did take 4 hours out of your day. You committed 4 hours to being here, which means you really wanted to be here. So let's focus on that part and the good that you can actually bring to being on this board and being part of this organization's story. We need all voices at the table. And so I said, I hope that you will, you know, that you will vow to at least finish out your term.
Yeah. And I guess my question is real, and I love what you're saying. And my question is really, you know, we need all voices. What is the obligation of all of us to, you know, to, try to bring people into the conversation? And this is right, like a bigger question probably than, you know, than people of color, you know, it has to do with probably introversion or people who aren't used to, you know, who maybe didn't grow up in a family where they are used to blurting or interrupting or, you know, making sure their voices get heard.
It's kind of that question. Yeah. Of like,
Do you call on people?
Brave space. Yeah.
So, like, I mean, I think each facilitator is different. And I do know that there are some cultures, you know, where in doing some race stories with board members, I've heard them say, we were taught not to speak up. Because we talk about race in terms of, you know, white, black, and how a lot of other groups feel invisible. So for instance, I had a board member, her name was Tina, and she was from Asian descent. And she said, you know, they were always taught, you know, you don't speak up. And whenever she ever heard about race, it was always white, black people. And so she just kind of felt like, well, they're not talking about me. So there's no need for me to say anything. So she says it's unlikely that if in a conversation, and in fact, in our training with her, she was quiet at the beginning. I'm the type of facilitator where I will call people. And just say, you know, Tina, we've not heard from you. I would love to hear what's on your heart and what's on your mind right now. Would you mind sharing? Now, I'm okay saying that. Renee might not, But I'm the type of person that will call you out and invite people. And of course, I don't force them. But I think once you, I don't know if people feel like they're on the spot now, or, and I think it's the way that you ask them to, you know, if we, I'd like to invite you to speak and share what's on your mind and what's in your heart. And if you say it like
I mean, I'm really struck by, I think a few things are rolling around in my mind. I think one thing is, like you said earlier, like there was, there's a big base that you're creating. Like if everyone is able to share their race story, then everyone has a deeper sense of understanding, you know, of where each person is coming from and why it may be or may not be, you know, easy or hard to speak out. And I think there's also a lot of, in the work that you're talking about, you know, in particular the teaching about white supremacy, like there's a lot of normalizing of like, we have all lived under this situation that has caused us to have these biases, right? Like it's not about us personally being like terrible, broken people, right? It's like we're all in this system together and we now have an opportunity to see the system and change the system. But I do think there's something really powerful in like, in starting with that sort of education for people so that they actually can see like, this is unfortunately a part of our culture, you know, that needs to change, but there is a normalization of like, we all have these biases within us that I do think helps people, right? Like you're not just asking people to say something without context setting of, absolutely, you know, like what is happening.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and I do a shocking exercise. You know, I'll say to people, you know, when we start, you know, anybody in the room that's ever been a slave, raise your hand. If you ever been a slave master, raise your hand. If you think your great-great-grandmother was a slave, raise your hand. If you think your great-great-grandfather was a slave master, raise your hand. Right? So I just kind of set the tone for, we're all conscious and aware that we ourselves were not around and we're not personally responsible for what happened back then. But maybe my great-great-grandmother was a slave. Maybe she was raped. Maybe her children were taken from her. Maybe her husband was killed. Maybe my great-great-grandmother, she was a white woman who was a missus on a plantation, right? And so we actually have that. And so when I say, if you've ever been a slave, raise your hand, you can see people go. So I kind of, it's a bold brazen exercise, but I do it intentionally to let people know, we're not saying you. We're not saying you, Margaret. We're not saying you, Janice. We're saying Margaret's great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother may have been. You know, Janice's great-great-uncle may have been. We don't know, but likely, right? And so we just kind of, you know, I kind of get that out of the way from the beginning. And I think that exercise, while a little shocking and maybe a little off-putting to people, because I believe in a little shock therapy every once in a while, I think it kind of sets the tone for, this is how we're going to roll in here. We're going to be pointed, but not pointy.
We call that a disorienting event, which is a very, as a facilitator, you know, that's what we refer to it as, is it's important because that's exactly what it does. Like it shocks a system and says something really different is about to happen here for the next 4 hours. You know, so that's incredible. I feel like we could talk to you all day, but we are going to have to start to wrap up. But we really, you know, encourage people to read the post. We'll link to that in the show notes. It's The End Game to Creating a Culture of Belonging on Nonprofit Boards. And Crystal, you know, we like to give our listeners something tangible to try. So what is something that you would like them to do as a result of listening to this conversation?
I think the race stories is something that most boards can probably handle if, you know, you give them the questions that you want them to ask. And, you know, we can do it two ways. You can give them the questions in advance and give them an opportunity to write it down and give it some real thought, and then come back to the group and share what they've written. Or you can just kind of ask in the moment and get some spontaneous answers to, let people kind of say, and you can see sometimes even when they're talking, some aha moments like I had, like, oh yeah, when I was a kid, so-and-so and so-and-so, and you kind of go, oh yeah. And you don't realize that when you start talking about some things come up and come out that maybe you hadn't talked about ever, but now comes to mind, and you're like, you kind of in that moment realizing it at the same time. So I think there's some value to doing it both ways, but I think having your board share race stories is a nice way. And we've had board members say, oh my God, I had no idea that you grew up like that, or that that was a tradition that you had, or, you know, it just makes me feel a little closer to you, or like I kind of understand more now, you know, a little bit about you. So I think that's an exercise that can be really eye-opening and enlightening, not only for the board members themselves, but maybe each for the board member who share it.
Yeah. And are there specific questions that people?
So it's just kind of like, you know, how do you identify now? How did your family identify? What did your parents say to you about your race or about other races? So questions like that.
Yeah.
When did you realize you were different? What kind of holidays did you celebrate? What kind of foods did you eat? Like, there are all kinds of prompting questions that you can answer. And we tell people, share what, you know, we give them some leads, but share what you want to share. We don't say you have to answer A, B, C, and D, but these are some things that you can talk about. And people will start bringing up, you know, oh, I was raised on a farm, you know, or I was raised in a, you know, in a Asian household where my father was very strict, you know, so those kinds of things start to come out.
And yeah, that's beautiful. You know, it just occurs to me, I'm in a book club, and that often comes out in our book club. It's interesting when reading a book that often the stories of like our parents, particularly our mothers, because we often read books that center on women characters, and it will bring up for us memories of our mothers. And I've learned so much about my friends, the kind of maybe they felt awkward taking certain foods to school. You know, all the kids had peanut butter sandwiches and, you know, they wanted like, so yeah, as you were saying that, I thought, oh, my book club does that, although we've never articulated it that way.
Yeah. Never been formal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that exercise.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you, Crystal.
Yeah. And before we go, Crystal, I know there's a link about your Planting the Seeds for Change program, but give us a quick little summary and how people can reach out to you to learn more about that.
Yeah. It's a deep dive experience. Usually lasts 3 to 6 months, depending on the board, where Renee and I come in and do some preliminary work. We do surveys. We interview board members. We even interview some staff to get an understanding of the relationship between the organization and the board. Then we do a findings report of what we find out as a result of doing that work, and we share that with the executive director. And then we come in and we both do our thing. I focus on bias, she focuses on white supremacy. And we've changed it up a few times. It's not, you know, set in stone, but that's kind of how it is. So it's called Planting the Seeds for Change, Seed, Water, Bloom. So I feel like we're seeding, and then, you know, we're watering, and then at the end, there's a hopefully a little plant that comes out of work that we do. So if you want to know more about it, you can visit my website at theboardpro.com.
Awesome.
Great. Thank you. Such a great conversation today, Crystal.
Thank you. I enjoy talking to you and sharing a little bit about our experiences as consultants. Yes. It's been very good work.
My stomach ache is gone. So yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
You feel empowered.
New things feel possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brave
yeah.
spaces.
Yes.
Love
that.
Yes. Yeah. I love that too. It's thank you for coming back, Crystal. I joke, but I do sort of think whenever I think like, oh, we need a good juicy topic on boards, I'm like, you gotta call Crystal. So I feel like you're our outsourced board pro.
Yes. Thank you, Janice, for having me.
Yeah. And also mention your children's book.
Thank you for remembering. I forgot. So I wrote a children's book called Mac and Cheese, Being Different is Okay. And it's a book to talk to children about some of these things, about accepting others who are different and helping them to belong on the playground or in the classroom or at the daycare center, kind of realizing, oh, she's different, or her hair is different, or she celebrates a different holiday, but it's okay. We can all still play and get along. And so it's called Mac and Cheese, Being Different is Okay. It's a book that teaches children about inclusion and acceptance. And you can pick a copy on Amazon, or you can go to my website, Mac and Cheese, M-A-C-A-N-D, Cheese, C-H-E-E-Z.com.
Great. Great. Awesome. I'm glad we remember that. So, so thank you again. And we like to share a free resource every week from Fundraising Leadership. So this week we wanted to highlight our coaching challenge, which is actually a 7-day challenge. You can sign up and give us your email. And then every day you'll get a little bit of a lesson about something related to coaching, like asking great questions and different ways to listen and follow that through. It can bring some great new tools to your leadership. So we encourage you, that'll be in the show notes, to click on that and join us for the coaching challenge. And just a reminder, Crystal has challenged us to, you know, take to your board this idea of sharing your race stories and getting to know each other better and creating a better sense of belonging. So we're going to invite you to go put that into practice.
This podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. Please subscribe if you haven't already. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a monthly or annual contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Make a contribution today using the link in the show notes. Now, go put it into practice. Curious.